Hello, listeners. Hi, I'm Dr. Margaret Vaughn, and welcome to Getting Smarter, a podcast where I get to talk with some of the most transformational thinkers and leaders in the field of education, all in the hopes of getting smarter. Join me in listening and learning. Welcome. Today we have the wonderful Dr. Ann Hess Dyson who's visiting us, and I am so thrilled. I'm a super fan, and welcome to the show. We're so happy to have you here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Well, I'd love to read your biography because you are amazing. I mean, so I'm gonna start us off with your amazing biography. So Dr. Dyson is a former teacher of young children and a fellow of the American Educational Research Association. Among her previous appointments was a longtime professor at the University of California, Berkeley, where she received the campus-wide Distinguished Teaching Award. She has spent over 42 years studying the childhood cultures and literacy learning of young school children, for which she has received numerous awards. Dr. Dyson aims first to bring respect and intellectual attention to childhood cultures and their relationship to school learning. Young children do not participate in school because they are concerned about the national economy, international competition, or climbing a ladder to the academic accolades from a grateful nation. They desire to make sense of their world and to gain companionship in what can be a confusing world. Second, Dr. Dyson aims to document the diversity of resources, languages, popular culture text, semiotic tools, everyday experiences our diverse school children bring with them, with which to participate intellectually and socially in school, especially in written language development. Her most recent book publications are published in 2016, Child Cultures, Schooling and Literacy, Global Perspectives on Children Composing Their Lives, and in 2021, Writing the Schoolhouse Blues, Literacy Equity and Belonging in a Child's Early Schooling. Wow. Wow. You are such a hero of mine and to so many people, and I just love you. I think you're wonderful. And so thank you for making the time today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You are just a star. And I have my books here that are very instrumental, Writing Superheroes, your other books, The Brothers and Sisters Learn to Write. And I have so many post-its and notes in here that I regularly visit. And I had those since I was a doctoral student. And you are just a hero. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right. So before we get started, I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about how did you get into the field of education and teaching? Tell me a little bit about that path.
All right. I want to say, first of all, that when I was at the university, I was really fascinated by geology and archaeology. Those were my passions, really. And I was just mesmerized by the idea that you could go deep into the earth and at the same time you could go deep into the evolution of humanity, of human cultures. And I know evolution is a kind of a funny word because it implies increasing progress, and it's hard to look at the world today and think we've made progress, but nonetheless, if you look long-term, you can see that. And the stories to be told varied with the earth you were imagining, you were looking at, you were studying. So I didn't pursue that passion, though. I decided not to. One is I don't have any depth perception. I was cross-eyed as a kid, and it wasn't fixed when I got to be an adult, and I had it cosmetically fixed, but if you don't fix it when they're young, then you don't get any depth perception. You just look with one eye. Oh. So I don't really know what depth perception is because I've never had it. But I do know that I have to go really slow on steps because they look flat, everything.
Oh, really?
So you fall a lot if you're not really, really careful. But I've always been really, really careful. So that was one problem because back then when I was in college, everything was in topographical maps. And I couldn't really get them. But the professors were very nice to me and they always had an assistant to tell me what I should see, but that didn't seem, it seemed like that was going to cause problems. And the other thing was, they didn't talk about how people made money from being an archaeologist. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't really understand anything about that. And I grew up in the 50s and 60s when women were nurses, which I associated with hospitals and people going to die, or secretaries, where you had a lot of paperwork, and I do not like paperwork. And third, you could be a teacher. So I decided to go into education. That is not an auspicious beginning. I thought I'll be a teacher because I thought, you know, I spent my school years in a little farm town, and my father died. We lived in LA, and then my father got sick and wanted to go back to Wisconsin. I don't know why I'm going into this, but I want to tell you that I grew up then, my school years, in this little farm town, and we, for a long time, we didn't have a car or anything. So my world was, I read a lot, and my mother was very fun, and we were happy, but we didn't have any money. So I didn't have any exposure to, you know, I was stuck with what the ideology was. And the ideology was women were secretaries like my mom. And I knew how much paperwork she had, and nurses. And I didn't want anything to do with hospitals and all that, because that was not good news for us. And then there was teachers. So, but the thing is, when I took my first teaching job, I, through a long story, we don't have time for me to tell, and I don't really know how I would tell it, but my first teaching job was kind of on the border in El Paso, Texas, in between Texas and Mexico. And I took this job over the phone and put things on a Greyhound and went to Texas.
Wow.
Why? But I did. I just wanted a job, and this didn't pay much, but I knew I would eat and everything would be okay. So I went, and when I got there, a lot of the kids came across the border every day, because back then the border, it was very different. The border was, we went back and forth all the time, and the kids went back and forth. So, but I didn't know where the kids were coming from, and I didn't know the kids. And I did remember that one thing I had learned through my education classes was that you have to teach by building on what people know, because if people don't, you can't build on what they don't have. There's no foundation there. So you have to know what kids know. So I thought, I have to get to know these kids. I can't teach them. So it turned into kind of an archaeology. I had to go deep and get to know them as individuals, as a group. I went across the border. I met parents, and that was fun because my Spanish was okay, but it wasn't very good. And their English, their parents' English wasn't very good. So it was just funny. It was just fun. And we liked each other in the end, even though we didn't really communicate, but the kids had a lot of fun, because they were bilingual, and they, I don't know. Anyway, so I did that, and I went to all the fairs, and I went to the marketplace, and I just loved it, and I loved the kids, and I found it all very intellectually and emotionally satisfying. So, and I kept thinking, I am an archaeologist, really. And I had liked ethnography, and I had taken a class with Doug Foley. I don't know if he's still well known, but he was very well known when I was at Texas, and he taught ethnography, and I learned a lot from him. And I thought, I'm an ethnographer and I'm an archaeologist after all.
Oh, I love that. So a couple questions. So was it advertised in the newspaper for the job? How did you learn of it?
I learned of this job. Well, you know, I was going to graduate, and back then the schools were offering jobs kind of in the mid to late summer, the new people. And I did get offered jobs, but by then I had already said I was going to Texas. So when it was near graduation, I was in the student union, and there was a little note on a bulletin board that said, teachers wanted, call Margaret Bumbliss, what's her name? We had other names for her, but that was her name. contact such and such. So I did. And it was a Catholic school in a parish, and they were looking for teachers, and they would, and to call. So I thought, well, all right. I didn't know anything, so I called, and it went well. And I thought, she certainly hired me fast, but okay then.
What grade was it? Was it young grades, or was it middle school? Was it?
It's little kids.
Little kids.
Little kids. I've always taught little kids. I think in my years of teaching, I did teach preschool, and I taught second grade, and then I kind of stuck with first grade for a while, because first grade was when reading and writing started. Although back then, you know, you weren't allowed to have pencils in the kindergarten, and
oh wow,
it's very, 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 very different. And in first grade, I started right away because I liked writing, and the kids were great, but you weren't supposed to start till the second semester, because the first semester you were supposed to do all this silly stuff. I just wasn't going to do visual perception. I thought, well, they're not bumping into anything, so I think I'm going to skip that. And auditory discrimination, and they could talk, so I don't know. I just skipped all that, and
I
just
love that.
We'll do it. We'll just start right away.
Was it multi-age in that group, or was it primarily kindergarten? Was that the kindergarten?
Back then, I was in first grade.
Okay.
And we weren't supposed to start the books and all that until January. And now, you know, you go into a kindergarten, and you think it's first grade. Just awful.
Yeah.
And kindergarten was fun, but reading was very important to me when I was little, and I would try to write. I didn't do well in school until they figured out I could already read. Because school, I started really late because we had just moved from LA, and my father asked my mother to put me in first grade, not kindergarten. So I didn't go to kindergarten. I was only five. And by the time I got in school, it was end of October.
Oh,
and so
yeah,
I didn't know anything. I got to wear my Sunday dress and my Sunday shoes. And I got my own box of colors. I didn't have to share it. And
that's lovely. Oh,
I thought this will be great. But then when I went, and I got a clown with balloons to color, and then I colored them, and I was being very careful. And then the girl sitting next to me, a aisle away, because everybody was in straight lines, which I thought was strange. But anyway, she was very concerned about my coloring, and she kept pointing to the letters in the middle of each balloon, saying, and then pointing to the, there was a clown with balloons, just like I had on the wall. And I said, well, I'm doing it the way I want to do it. And she said, no.
Wow.
And the nun came, and she put an F. Because you weren't supposed to help each other, which, of course, is just the opposite of what I say.
Yeah.
That was my, and she put an F on mine. I luckily didn't know what that meant, except that she had ruined my picture.
Oh,
so I hated school.
Oh.
I just thought these people. And so anyway, I didn't have a great start, but I went to before my father died, he did take me to the library, and there was a real nice woman there, Vera Schwartz. And she showed me where the kids' books were, and by the end of the year, I was reading 10,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh, wow.
All that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I But at school, I didn't do anything until I think third grade. Yeah, third grade, I had Mrs. Gruber. She was great. And she noticed that I was looking around this big book, and she said, "Can you read that?" And I said, "Oh, yes." And I read it to her. And I told her I write stories too, and I showed her one, and she said, "Oh my goodness!" And she told everybody, and then all of a sudden, everything changed at school, and because of course, what they expected from me was very different, and then that was just interesting. So from that, I got this great interest in the social lives of kids because I kept talking in school. Just one reason I was on. I just, I was from a big family and I talked. And so I just kept talking because I didn't see any reason not to talk. And then, yeah, so when I got into researching, I really liked classrooms that let the kids talk. And
How did you, those experiences you tell as from your early childhood, it makes so much sense with your worldview and how your writing and had you always carried that with you throughout? I mean, as your teacher and then as you transitioned to as a researcher?
yeah,
Yeah.
I did, because I think kids' conversations are so fun, and the drama of it, and that's what I really loved when I got into research, which was another kind of inauspicious beginning. I was putting my husband at the through school, through undergraduate school, and through my not very lucrative teaching job, but I was enjoying my teaching job. And we were in Austin now. And Austin was a very nice place in the 70s. It was a very nice place. I haven't been back. I'm sure it's still nice, but then it was small and it was just fun. And Whole Foods, which is now a big corporation, was just a little dive.
Oh, really?
You go and get your lentils. And, we were kind of hippie like, and he looked like a hippie, but I didn't because I had to go to school. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, so I was putting him through school. So I thought, well, I'm good at school. I should take a couple classes. And I did, and I didn't really enjoy them, but it was fun to be in school. And then Celia Ganeshi, who I've written with over the years, and who is my very best friend, but she had just graduated from Berkeley, and I had no idea Berkeley was going to figure into my life at all. And I didn't even know it was a, I didn't even know really. I knew there was a university there, and that people like me didn't go there. But anyway, she came and she taught a class on applied social linguistics in education, and I loved languages. I had concentrated in languages and the geology stuff in undergraduate school before I switched to education. And anyway, she showed us how she did her dissertation, and it was very ethnographic. And she asked us to do a small scale project, a qualitative ethnographic project. So I went to somebody else's classroom, and I just sat there and watched the kids. And oh my God, it was so fun because I could see, I went during when they were doing writing, and I could see the social life around it and the dramas and the the passion of their relationships was just, oh my God, it was better than the movies. I just loved it. And I could see things going on that I knew went on, but I hadn't ever been able to study it. So I thought, I like this. I like this. I want to do this. So I just got a, I figured out that that's what PhD meant, and I got one. And I just kept going. I just kept it up.
Oh, that's fascinating. So, did you stay in the classroom while you pursued your PhD, or did you?
I found it really
Too
hard.
hard, yeah.
I found it really hard because I was pretty passionate
Yeah.
about this work and what I was doing, trying to figure out how literacy figured into the social lives of children and what sense they made of it, because it was just interesting all the ways they thought of it. Some of the kids did things that I had read Amelia Ferrero talk about, like they put a lot of letters for their dad and fewer letters for their mom, and then an elephant would get a lot of letters. Just to follow their logic and how
Yeah.
they talked about it and how they figured things out, and all the social life going on around it, and the from things like just what are you doing, and you want to do this too, let's do this, and plan things related to writing, but also a lot of things related to relationships. And writing got all figured into these relationships. Like you said, you were going to do this and you were going to put me in there and you didn't. So I'm not going to put you in mine. And it was just all so fun. It was fun, and it was also intellectually very interesting because
Yeah.
nobody really talked about writing in that way. That was the time of Donald Graves, and he was starting, and his work got a big splash, but it was very different from what I was doing because he was
Yeah.
looking at kids from the point of view of, an adult,
Yeah.
like
Yeah.
a journalist or a literature writer. And I was looking at it from the point of view of childhood. So my writing was really different. And also, he was looking at middle class kids, and I always went to schools serving. I was always in cities, and I went to schools like the ones I would have gone to if we had stayed in LA that were very diverse, or if there was a predominance of kids, they were Black kids, African American kids. And so, and they were, I never, I just, I also was conscious of income. Having not grown up with much, I was interested in those kids because I figured I had the opposite view of the dominant one, which was, oh, these kids are lacking resources. I thought, no, these kids have a lot of resources and they'll be fun.
Yeah.
So I went there. And so, but because their parents both worked a lot, and the kids were culturally different and diverse themselves. I forgot where I was going now with this. Oh, where was I going with this? What did you ask me?
I think we were talking about how you transitioned, I think, into becoming a, going to school. Did you stay in the classroom? And if you, how you transitioned, how you just navigated that?
Oh, I see. Yeah. So I really got into writing, and I got into, oh, I knew where I was going. I was going to say that when I was in the classroom, I realized because I had started taking these education classes, and because I had observed kids, I started realizing how different I was from what people were writing. And that I thought they should look, not look from the perspective of school at what kids have or have not, but from the perspective of kids and their perspective on school and what matters to them. Because then you learn about all different kinds of resources that they draw on, and you have many more resources as a teacher to draw on. I know because when I was teaching, I told you about how we had to do all these, well, we didn't have, I didn't do them, but we were supposed to do all these visual and auditory perception things that were with pictures. And I thought, well, I don't think they have problems with pictures. So I started them. I learned they were very into Charlie Brown then and Snoopy. So I taught them. They all knew their names, and they were learning to write them. And I said, well, all these characters have names too. So we started with Snoopy, and who has a name that starts like Snoopy and all that.
I love that.
We learned, you know, and Sally has a name like Snoopy. So we went through all the names and things, and then we wrote little stories. First, they dictated them, and then I got a coloring book and got all these Snoopy pictures that had, you know, and Charlie Brown figure. And I said, if they wanted, they could take a picture and do their own story. And so, because they were just figuring out, this is what I was going to say, Donald Gray said, kids can start writing when they have two sounds that they know. And I thought, that's nuts. These kids are going to learn that, but they're going to learn it by the end of the year. We're going to start with what they like, words. Yeah. So I don't know if you ever read Sylvia Ashton Warner's book, Teacher.
Yeah.
I had read that and I really liked it. So I'm going to start with their words.
I love that.
And so, but I'm going to teach everything you need to know about literacy as best I can, but they're going to teach each other too, because they're going to pay attention to each other's names, which they did, and the names of these characters. And it was interesting to watch how their stories developed, because first they would put down the names of objects and things in the picture, and then they would tell the story, and then I could say, well, there's some words there. Okay, so there's the word is, Snoopy is, and this how you spell is, let's put it in here. And then I went from giving them cards to giving them books. I mean, like word books. So wow. Let's put I and let's put is in it. Wasn't that funny? Is in it. You know, so anyway, and then as they went along, they got sick of the word book, and they started, and they got used to the sound thing. And then they started what was being called invented spelling. And I just thought the wonder of, you know, when kids make progress, they make errors. And that I just thought they're spelling wrong, but they're spelling right.
Oh, I love
that. That was towards the end. And so I just, and that was when everybody was coming out and saying, no, this is a natural way. And I thought, well, maybe for your kids.
Yeah.
Right. And so
it's easy to see now how groundbreaking your work is, but at the time, did you have a sense that this was so unique and that you were going to have this huge impact? I mean, that probably sounds like a dumb question, but I mean,
I did know that. And I was never successful, really, I think. Well, actually, I was successful, especially in Australia. But I didn't ever feel like I had that big of an impact. But I did want to say something. I wanted to say that kids can start with whatever they have, but the teacher has to start with what they have, too. Yeah. It's not okay if you have a curriculum.
Yeah.
And then the kids have to figure out that curriculum. You have to figure out what the kids are doing, and then you build on that. And I thought they're losing the fundamental principle of teaching and learning. You have to build on what you have. And I wanted to say that. And I wasn't reading anything. Everybody was just going gung-ho over, you know, just tell them to write and they'll invent spelling. And I thought, no, they won't. Maybe your kids will, but my kids didn't. And I had a lot of kids over the years. And yeah. I was a successful teacher. So I had met Celia, and I decided that I was going to get that PhD. I was going to watch kids. I was going to write about kids. And I was going to try to have an impact. And I think when I started, nobody else was looking at that I knew of anyway. I hadn't read anybody who, except Sylvia Ashton Warner, who looked at kids from the point of view of what they had and in their life together, because literacy has to be meaningful for them.
Mm-hmm.
I think the idea of the social life of kids, I think I did have a bit of an impact there.
Oh, yeah.
Lots of people doing that. But
you know, you're huge. Don't underplay. I mean, you're enormous in the field. So you're so humble, but your work is just so groundbreaking. I mean, I told you, I'm a super fan, but just the sensibility and how you are able to really capture what that social world that you're, I feel like we lose so much of that in the way that we think about policy. And you know what I mean? I think your work is so pivotal and critical. It stands time. I mean, I think it's interesting that your own experiences as a child really, it makes sense that really has shaped your own view on how you were a teacher and how you, what brought you to the work, it sounds like.
Yeah. Yeah, I did. Although I did want to be a geologist, yeah. I'm very glad that I didn't. I think I really enjoyed my career, especially the stories that I've just, the things I've learned in all the projects I've done, I've just taken what I've learned and got on to the next one and tried to figure out where I wanted to work, and given where I was, what could I learn from this place? What are these kids going to teach me? And until this last project, I always chose rooms where I could get to know the kids. And that really was not hard at all until most recently, when I think the curriculum has become so bad. Kids will approach things in all different ways, right? They're, and school has to be open. We're a democracy, or so they say, so we hope we say, and we are responsible to everybody. So you have to have the task so that everybody can enter into them with whatever they have. But now, at least locally, they've taken the so-called Common Core, and they've divided it up into little bitty skills, and they're all benchmarked. So in kindergarten, by the fifth week of school, when I was doing that project, they were supposed to be able to invent spelling. So five weeks. And of course, they're constructing, what they are doing is constructing the achievement gap.
Mm-hmm.
In the school that Tavon went to, Tavon is the little kid that I followed all those years, and he started out in this great preschool. It was a wonderful preschool where it was very play-based, and the teacher was, concern was to make sure all the kids developed language. And when Tavon went, he wasn't speaking that much. But by the time he was ready to turn five and go to kinder, he talked. Because the teacher would say, she would have them play, and then she would have them talk to each other. And if parents came, she'd say, well, go talk to the kids. You'll enjoy them. Have fun. Encouraged talk. And the way she had her whole group meetings, they were always, she would ask them questions, she would repeat what they said, and then she would say, well, what does anybody else think about what he said? And then they just blossomed in there. They just blossomed, and he blossomed too. He was just so kind to other people. He lived a lot of times with his grandma, and she did a great job with him because he was always concerned. There was one time when I was in this room, the preschool, and there was a kid who just had acted out horribly, I must say. And she said he could sit on the rug and think about what he had done, which of course he wasn't going to do. I mean, he sat, but I'm sure he wasn't thinking about what was done. But anyway, and they were going to do something with Plato, I think. I can't quite remember what it was. They all went into their little tables, and Tavan looked at the teacher and he said, "Do you think so-and-so could come? We have a room." And she said, "Oh, all right."
Oh.
Wasn't a friend of his. I mean, the kid had taken and smashed his train. That's what he did, this kid. But Devon wanted him to come and sit because he was all by himself.
Oh.
I just thought he was just the greatest kid.
Yeah.
If Devon was, he is. He's African American. His dad was really small, and he's really small, but he's just a real cute kid. But then he went to kindergarten, and the school, it has a, because of history, because of how they, when blacks would come up from the south to the north, there was a lot of railroad building and a lot of crop work too in the Midwest. But the town had all the black people live in the north of the town. They did not fund it well. People lived not good conditions. But it was horrible. But that happened all over. And so, like many cities, this city has, you can see, it's segregated. Not as much as it was in the beginning, but still it's segregated. So the school district, therefore, their schools are segregated too, not on purpose, but just because of redlining. And so the school assigned him to a far south school where the majority was white. Most of the, when they started assigning kids, most of, there was a great increase in white people in the private schools. But this school kept its school, really, but the district assigned Tavan to this school. So I was there on the first day of kindergarten, and he walked into the classroom, and he had a big smile on his face when he came in with his dad, walked him to his classroom, and he was thrilled to see me. "I knew you would come," he said. "I knew you would come." He introduced me to the other kids as, "This is my friend from preschool."
And
one girl said, "Well, how old are you?" You know.
That's cute.
It was pretty cute. So anyway, I saw him stiffen up. He kept a smile on his face, but he was stiff because it was such a different environment than the very diverse one he had been in. So I saw, but he was very friendly to everybody. But I saw, first of all, how the other kids treated him. I think I wrote about this in those articles I sent you.
Yeah. Oh, they're lovely. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first day of school, they're saying to him,
"Yeah,
well, if ever you need help, you can just ask us." You know, this was the so-called bright kids who had come and taken their kindergarten test before kindergarten because they were in the neighborhood. And the parents all knew what was on the test, unlike the kids who were bussed in. They didn't know. Their parents didn't know. They thought it was like kindergarten when they went to kindergarten. Yeah. They didn't. And so Tavan's mom wrote a note saying he really loves the dress-up corner, and he isn't a crier, and all these things. Like it was back in the old kindergartens.
Yeah.
But the neighborhood parents, they knew that the kids were going to be tested, and they primed them. And the kids who scored real, real high, the teacher referred to as the bright kids.
Yeah.
So God hadn't taken those kind of time tests before. He wanted to talk about everything. Oh, this letter is in my name, And you know, it's timed. So he ended up with a very low score.
Wow.
He didn't even have, they didn't know his score, the other kids. They just absorbed what's in the air.
Yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. So that those pieces, I mean, so did anything about that research surprise you? I mean, just across your research and, you know, and your career, have there been any surprises, things that you didn't really expect that you would find, or just nuggets? I don't know. What do you think?
I think that I'm always surprised but always it's happy surprises up until that project. You know, like just the things kids would say or the insights I would get. And I would think, oh, I'm so lucky I saw this. Oh my goodness. And then I just really enjoyed telling those stories. In fact, I brought a story today. It's from the Social World book. Then I thought, well, if I get a chance to tell a story, I'll tell
it. Yeah, tell it. Tell it. We want to hear it.
I'll tell it. But first, I'll answer this question. So I went to, when I went to Tavon's class, I'd seen things. And certainly in the Oakland, Berkeley area where I'd been working, I'd seen, you know, I'd seen things, but I also saw that the kids, if the teacher was good, the kids had a sense of being in a class community. But when they chose their friends, the black kids and the white kids did separate. And they were so different, really. The black kids' English was different. I just love the verbal play.
Yeah.
They're so quick. Not all of them, but, you know, the ones who are quick, they're really fun. And I don't know, I was just always surprised by things that would happen, and they were always good things that surprised me. But when I went to Devon School, I knew about, I had never been, not as a kid, not as a teacher, not as a researcher, in a predominantly white class. They were always very diverse. So, and I knew things happened, but when they came up to him and said, the so-called bright kids, and said, if you ever need help, we'll help you. He didn't know what to say. And I thought, oh my God, well, maybe this is just a fluke, but it kept happening. It kept happening. And it was clear that he was not regarded as what he was, which is a very smart, very polite. Although the teachers cued into the fact that this is a nice kid, but they didn't cue in to all his resources and all he knew. And this was a surprise to me. And then I realized it was all because they're looking for these skills, because they have to give all these tests, all on these very isolated skills. So in the kindergarten, it was letters and sounds. And she had them right. And she liked him. I knew she did. But she really saw her job as to teach this objectives. And they were all benchmarked, and they were all tested constantly. So she was definitely looking at him from the point of view of the skills that were listed. Mm. But that isn't the way that he approached writing. And actually, by mid-year, she said he writes much better than the bright kids. But just saying that,
oh yeah,
he wasn't bright.
Yeah.
And he did learn to write, but not according to the way they thought he should learn to write. But
how was that for you as a you know, as a teacher and as a social justice person? I mean, I know in the spirit of ethnography, you can't really, you know, how did you interact? Like, were you stunned? Were you shocked when those comments, what did you do? Were you just like, you know, how did you?
I first of all, I trusted him. He was never mean back, and they thought they were being kind, I think.
Yeah.
they thought they were being nice. They didn't realize that they had absorbed the
culture,
culture, which, you know, just because they're doing all this narrow testing, they that list, that checklist, that of the bright and the not so bright, that reinforces a sense of hierarchy and who's on the top and who's on the bottom. And it just constructs the so-called achievement gap, which the schools themselves create. It's not that there aren't problems associated with poverty, et cetera, but nonetheless, most of the kids, I think, are just fine. But the curriculum does not build on what they know. It says, well, this one doesn't know this. They don't know this. And then it keeps track of what they don't know.
Yeah.
I think, well, how is that fair? How is that fair? It isn't fair.
Yeah.
They are constructing the very thing they're worried about, the achievement gap. So that really crystallized for me when I did that long project of spending all those years with Tavan. But there was a happy surprise, because in second grade, you know, I wrote in the one piece about how they had the large writing time, which was all tied to the textbook, and where they had to write all these genres and they had to include these words, like if it was a narrative, it should be first and then and if it was nonfiction, there were other words they were supposed to use. I can't remember what they were now because I don't think I used them. I would have gone second grade, I think. So their texts were evaluated according to these objectives that the teacher was use these words and all this. But she had an open journal time, which was, she never read them, but they were just an activity for kids to do when she was doing reading groups. And in that, I saw him, what he was learning about the blues. And it was just amazing. He knew all about the start of the blues. He named all the people, like Big Mama Thornton. And he knew her songs and he could sing like her. And he wrote all he was learning. It was just amazing. And then sometimes he would write lyrics and he would sing them. And other kids would hear this. He would sing them very quietly, but they would hear this. And then during lessons, he would listen and he learned everything, but he would be doing rhythms, blues-like rhythms, on his padding his legs, sometimes his arms, once in a while his hands, but really quietly. He was just full of music. It was just amazing. And his journal was, I was just flabbergasted. And I read a lot of books on the blues, so I could appreciate what he was saying. And it was just amazing. And I kept thinking about, well, you know, I tried to talk to her. She said, oh, yes, I know he's a good singer. I thought, oh, yes, but he knows a lot. But anyway, if she would just have looked, they were trying to write nonfiction. One of the second grade objectives was to write nonfiction. But if she had given him a appreciation and made space for him, think about the nonfiction things he was writing.
Yeah,
and a whole chapter book on different kinds of blues singers, and he had all kinds of narratives. He knew the relationships between some of the people. Like, oh, I can't think right now because it's been too long since I watched him, but there was a couple of blues singers where they were brothers, and one had died, and they had a big celebration. inspiration for him. And one blues singer had sung his songs. And he knew this whole story.
Wow.
The whole story. And he knew the story about Natalie Cole, too. He knew who her father had been. He knew that she had had trouble with drugs, but she was an amazing singer. And he could have written stories as narratives, but he didn't get a chance. But he did write them, and he wrote them in his own journal, and he kept that up for months.
That's
and
great.
months. And I got amazed by him. And I got mad at the school.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. How did you reconcile that? You know, what did you do with that? I mean, just I'm wondering as a teacher, as a researcher, how did you channel that? I mean, through your writing, I know, but how did you manage that? That sounds like that must have been intense.
It was hard, but he was happy. He was a good kid, and he took it all with good humor, which sort of bothered me, but something else happened in second grade. First of all, the teacher did this thing that I think a lot of teachers do, which I don't think they quite think through before they do it. They put a kid they regard as not bright with a bright kid in seating so that the bright kid can help the other kid. And that creates all kinds of... That just reinforces the bright sense of himself, and it doesn't allow for the fact that sometimes the not bright kid may actually be pretty bright.
Yeah.
Devon, I often in that project would try to tell people things, you know, that, hey, you know, I'm right. I you're doing it wrong. he I don't know if I can find it, but. There was this one time when Dirk, the teacher had asked the kids, she'd given all the kids a sheet of paper, and one side was contractions, and the other side was the two words they were made out of, like cannot. And then she asked them to match them, to cut them out, cut out all the pieces, and then match them. And I don't know if I can find it real fast. I'll just have to tell you, I think. So the Dirk, who was the kid he was always stuck with, he came up with this idea that, you can just cut out these columns and paste them next to each other. And Devon knew that wasn't right, so I'm going to read you this part. The second graders were given a worksheet. You know, I'm not letting you ask any questions.
I love this. No, I love. No, you're perfect.
The second graders were given a worksheet task in which they were to cut out each of the box contractions in one list, like can't, and each of the box two-word phrases in a second list, will not. Each list seemed to be randomly ordered. On a separate paper, they were to match contractions and word phrase. Dirk was thrilled because he had thought up a, quote, shortcut, unquote. One could just cut out each list and paste the two lists as they were on another paper. One shook his head. They were supposed to cut out all the little boxes and then, quote, sort them and match them on the new sheet. No, said Dirk, just cut the paper in half. No, you have to match them. Just do it like I'm doing it, Dirk said firmly, and he put his paper on the done pile. And Devon went back to his cutting. He just said,
oh, great.
With him. He would make side comments to me all the time. And I was happy because I could see there were a couple of other minoritized kids in there. And I could see they were pretty much defeated. But Devon was never defeated. He told me, I'm smart. He just knew he was smart. And he was smart. But the bright, so-called bright kids were just bright, you know. And they would tell him things and he just didn't lose it over it. He didn't lose it over it. And his grandma put him in the, had him try out for, and he got in the regional children's choir.
Oh, that's lovely. That's wonderful.
Wonderful. It was just wonderful. And he loved it. And they gave concerts in the Kranath Center for the Arts is a big performance place at the university. And he was on, he got to go there and sing. Oh. And it was wonderful. So because he had his grandma and because he had the regional children's choir, and because he also, his grandma had grown up in New York, and she lived at the same block where Malcolm X lived for a while. So she was very, very knowledgeable about and had been active in the civil rights movement. And she taught all this to Tavon and his, the older sister and the brother who was about his same age. She taught it to them because they stayed with her a lot. They pretty much lived with her.
Yeah.
And he got very into, he knew this, and sometimes he wrote about it in his own journal. And he got very back into being Black. It wasn't that he wasn't into being Black, but he just really associated with the other Black kids who were spread out through all the classes. I don't know why they did that. I don't know why they didn't put them together, but anyway, they didn't. But they would meet sometimes on the playground, and he decided that he wanted to grow his hair out again because he had had braids in the kindergarten and the preschool, but then they were cut off into an afro when he went to first grade. But in second grade, he decided he wanted to grow his hair out. And his hair was, it was pretty long if you stretched it out, but he wanted to grow it long enough to have braids again. And he learned the Chicago Bop dance
group.
And the way he dressed and even the way he walked changed. And I just thought he's going to be okay.
Yeah.
Be okay. And I just hope that, you know, there'll be teachers who will, he'll get out of this school and there'll be teachers who believe in him.
Yeah. Have you ever wondered where he is? And
you know. I did keep up with him and I kept visiting with him until once he was at his parents' house, not with his grandma, and there was a fight between his dad and his mom, and the neighbors called the police and the kids were taken out of the home.
Oh.
And the problem was, I mean, he had a home with his grandma, but in Illinois, the grandparents have no power. So I couldn't keep up with him.
Yeah.
But I really regretted it. But I know pretty soon, he's in middle school now, and I know in pretty soon he will be able to get a driver's license. And then I think he'll come see me.
I love that.
I don't think he's out of my life forever.
Oh, good.
Close friends.
Yeah.
Friends. I was an adult. I don't try not to be an adult, but I am a friend. And that's how he introduced me.
Nice.
So I think he's not gone.
But I love that. I love that you have a connection with him. Always. I mean, I find that so fascinating. So I was going to ask you too. So how about given your career, striving to transform thinking, how about what's your current view or current advice to the field?
Well,
that's a tough one, but
I think that until I just retired, but like I said, I don't notice any difference really. I don't notice any difference at all. I think if I get a chance, what's my current view of the field? If I look at what's going on in the local schools, I feel like, oh God, we're back to the old, what do they call it? The new science of reading, which is very, very old. Very, very old. And we're back to the tension between whatever you're going to call it, the whole language and the language and phonics is basically what it is, but they call it our whole word or context. Don't teach kids to use context, which I find funny.
Yeah.
I certainly use it.
Yeah, I do too.
Anyway, and because the tests are all about letters and sounds, of course the kids who, that's what they've been taught, that they'll probably do better. But it's so unfair and it's so stupid. I even saw something in the New York Times. I get the Times online. I get the local paper for the school news, but it's not very good. But I like the school news and I like the puzzles. I like word puzzles.
Uh-huh.
Oh, anyway, what was I saying? Oh, the New York Times had something about, well, the new science of reading. And I thought, what are the hell?
It's not new.
All science. We've had this off and on for years. And yet, when I think about what have we learned in the years, I think we've learned that literacy is very complicated social practice, that kids enter into it first through their play, if they have those opportunities to play, and they enter into it by reading, although they're not reading words exactly, they're reading the pictures and what they remember, especially if it's been read to them many times. And we know kids may come from many different kinds of literacy practices, so we have to figure out what they think of when they think of it. And we have to start with what they know, whatever it is, and go from there. And I think that's what I've learned over the years. And I look at the schools and I think, but why didn't they learn it? Where have they been? Why the new science of reading, especially in schools that teach kids that are coming from low-income homes, they're going to really drill on that because that's what the tests are going to be about. And I think it's a shame. So I think if we just keep our noses in academe, it seems like, oh, well, yes. But in the school, it's becoming very, very hard for even knowledgeable teachers to teach if they're in very mandated systems. The kids have to be tested all the time, which they do in the local schools. Test, test, test. I get discouraged. I get discouraged.
Yeah.
So I think we have to keep talking not just to each other, but to the public. And I want to participate in that now that I assume at some point all these people are going to get through all these dissertations sitting on my desk.
And you're so popular.
I don't know. But anyway, I think I have found a local after-school neighborhood program that is open to kids of all ages, including really little ones. And I beginning next week when I think two people will be done of the two people I have, I'm going to volunteer there and I'm sure I'll meet the parents.
That's great.
And so I hope to at least locally.
Oh, they'll be so lucky. They'll be so lucky to have you in their life.
But I want to stop. I want to talk to the public. The public should be upset.
Yeah.
And I just think that that's a problem. I think it's a problem.
Yeah. Well, you are just an amazing person. And I just, you know, want to thank you so much for your work and the work you continue to do. It's just, I love that you're an advocate for children and their worlds. I feel like we so need that. that voice. And so I just want to say thank you for just being so awesome.